You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org. Hello, everyone. This is Deep Tran, Associate Editor of American Theater Magazine, and you're listening to a very special edition of Off Script. This is our very first live podcast, which we recorded at the 2016 TCG National Conference in Washington, D.C., hosted by our publisher, Theater Communications Group. In it, we talk about artists in D.C. and the theater scene there as well. There are some technical difficulties during the recording, so there may be some volume issues towards the second half of this, but I hope it won't affect your listening experience too much. Enjoy!
So welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical, in this very special live edition at TCG 16 in Washington, D.C. We're a live show, so let us know you're here. Okay. So I'm Rob Weiner-Kent. I'm the editor-in-chief of American Theater. I'm here with...
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And also our special guest...
Peter Marks from the Washington Post.
Yes, indeed. Thanks for being with us, Peter.
Pleasure.
Tell us about DC theaters. Is it alive and well and healthy? The state of our theater?
Very
well?
Healthy.
Yeah.
Very, very healthy. It's a 12-month a year enterprise. The summer is as exciting as any time of the year. New musicals opening this summer. We've got plays coming from Britain. We've got Broadway shows now being done by resident companies.
Right.
So it's a really, really good time for you guys all to be here.
Forgive me for not knowing this, but how long have you been on this beat?
It's now 37 years. No, I've been here since 2002.
Okay.
So it's almost 15 years.
Almost 15 years. And if you could say what you have seen change in that amount of time, that's a big question. But
There has been a fundamental metamorphosis of Washington Theater in almost every sense since I came.
Okay.
Physically, almost every company has built an amazing new facility, from Arena Stage, which is a spectacular three-theater campus,
right,
covered in a beautiful dome, to Studio Theater expanding into new spaces, to Woolly Mammoth being in a new space, to the Shakespeare Theater Company opening a large 800-seat theater to go along with a 400-seat theater. So it's huge,
right,
in
okay.
terms of the growth physically. And I'd say there's also been a complete transformation of programming in this city. The emphasis on new work is extraordinary. I can't even count the number of world premieres and plays by young emerging playwrights that I see in this town.
Right.
And that kind of work ranges from the classical companies that are actually even bringing in new work to organizations that you'll hear from later, like The Welders, which
right.
is a playwrights collective.
Right.
So it's happening on so many levels. The creative engine seems to be driven by all sectors in this city.
It does seem to me that apart from Joy at the studio, there hasn't been a big generational changeover, and a lot of the same leaders who were part of the early movement are still at the helm of the big theaters, but there's a lot of other newer, younger theaters that are bringing in new voices. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, there are some artistic directors in this town whose reigns rival Queen Elizabeth's.
Yeah.
but also there are younger companies that are forming from the ground up, whose leaders are yet to really sort of assert themselves as major figures, but you have groups like Pointless Theater Company, which sort of emerged organically from the University of Maryland, which is exactly the kind of organization you want to have happen. It's people who know the area and who come from the area and want to make art for the area. So that's the kind of leadership I'm seeing in terms of what's changing, and it's not so much coming from top-down leadership at organizations of large scale like Arena and Shakespeare. The new leaders are going to come from this other cohort.
Other cohort, yeah.
Here's
right.
what I'm curious about, Peter. So you've been doing this for 37 years, which is, you know,
longer
than I have.
Let's correct that. I have not been doing it for 15 is...
15, yeah, okay. Sorry, I'm not good with numbers. I'm an arts person.
I understand.
But how do you keep the magic alive? Like, how do you... You view plays out 3-4 times a week. Like,
yeah.
How do you find things to keep loving about this field?
Well, you know, it was my first love. So that's what I renew. And, you know, there's something about something that happens to you when you're 5 years old, that spark that is ignited then, you keep wanting to reignite. It's so deeply embedded in who I am that I can locate it very easily when I see something that thrills me, and right. I can still find incredible joy in a new writer, an actor who's clearly on their way to somewhere else, a director who shows me a way to do theater I never thought of before. These are extraordinary moments, and that's doesn't matter if you've been doing this for 2 years or 40 years.
Right.
You know, you know that in theater practitioners. You know the people who still love it from that side, too, who can, you know, can summon that very, very readily. It's just visceral, really.
I think this is something that people don't know about theater critics and journalists, and just, like the theater practitioners, they have that passion for it. It's certainly not the money that brings us to it.
You can't last doing this if you don't enjoy doing it.
Right.
It's just not. It's not possible. You can't go at if a sourness. If people perceive a sourness coming into you and a kind of jaded quality to what you write, it's reflected in the product that you deliver to a reader.
Yeah.
And you know what? You're not going to be around much longer.
Right. Right.
You're really not.
So I just want to briefly. That's a deep.
Sorry. Oh, I was going to say, like, in journalism, like theater, you don't do it for the money.
Well, of course.
Oh, I've done it only for the money, and that was a mistake.
He's living like a king, and you don't know it.
Yeah. No. Of course. I didn't start as a theater critic. In fact, my beginnings were as an actor in college, and I actually sort of loathed critics who wrote about the shows
right.
that I was in. So it was never in my trajectory. But journalism is also like theater. I think it's a calling.
Right. 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 Since we did our last podcast, there's been we didn't do a post Tony's wrap up, which really wouldn't be our focus mostly at American Theater. Although there were a lot of nonprofit based, as there always is on Broadway. A lot of the shows on Broadway, including Hamilton, Fun Home, that wasn't this year's Tony's, but the biggest shows on Broadway. And The Humans was actually, you know, produced by a nonprofit theater on, well, actually not on
Before
Broadway.
Chicago.
Technically.
Chicago.
Well,
American Theater
too.
Company
American
with an
theater.
ER.
So I don't know if there's anything to say about it. You wrote a good post-Tony's column. I don't know. That's getting outside D.C., although D.C. has its links as well.
Eclipse started here. Eclipse started at Woolly Mammoth.
That's right.
Was that the world premiere? I thought it was at Yale first.
Well, Yale.
No, it was not. It was
a lot of squabbling
Woolly
about
Mammoth
that.
Before it went
yeah,
to Yale.
Exactly.
And one of the main characters was an actress by the name of Uzo Aduba.
Yeah.
What?
Who went on to Fame and Fortune and Orange is the New Black and a multiple Emmy winner.
Right.
I had to go back to my review and remember that she was in it. I had forgotten completely. You know, it's funny that happens. Again, part of the joy of this job is you're reviewing people. You just don't know where the heck they're going to end up.
Right.
I know. I saw Uzo Aduba and Leslie Odom Jr. do this really subpar musical at the Public called Venice.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was some years ago.
Sorry. Are there any Venice fans in the house?
But I thought they got the Tonys right this year. I thought it was a really good year for theater in so many ways, and obviously led by, you know, the young prince of Broadway, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Right.
But beyond that, I thought that it was really fortunate to have a play like The Humans win for Best Play. And here's the other interesting thing. I thought the two plays they picked as best revivals were actually reinventions of those plays. They really, in the best sense of the term revival, they created a new way to look at both A View from the Bridge and The Color Purple in very different senses. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
So I thought it was, an incredibly uplifting year for theater. It was a great advertisement for theater everywhere.
Right, right. To have theater part of the national conversation at all is a...
So I mean, how much of it was due to Hamilton, though? Because it had Hamilton, the best ratings it had in 15 years, and
Hamilton's
so next year, is it going to be the same?
Well, but James Corden, I thought, brought a different kind of energy to what he was doing. He made theater seem positively fun. He made it seem like, I want to do that, too. And I've never felt that before. Or even the guys like Neil Patrick Harris who've done this, they were, there's a kind of ironic, jaundiced sort of thing, and there's a slightly sneering thing that goes on. Even, I mean, Hugh Jackman, you know, God bless him, you know, is a wonderful worshiper of theater. But I thought that Corden had the joy of it.
Yeah.
And that is something you can't communicate.
He's got the show kid, like he's watched Broadway shows.
Exactly.
Like
happy to be here.
Yeah, like those Star Kids people. Like he has got that kind of energy to it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Totally true.
So I don't want to shuffle you off too quickly, but we have some. Oops, sorry.
Oh God.
Was that a bad sound thing? All right.
Oh no! It was more like water and tech.
We have some great guests here. We wanted to talk about a company here in DC called the Welders, which has deep. You've written a bit about this troupe and about the trend of playwright-driven theaters. You want to talk a little bit about that, and then we'll introduce them as they make their way to the stage.
Right, right. Well, there is this group in New York City called 13P. I'm sure we have all heard of them, and Sarah Rule, Madeline George. It was a group of 13 playwrights. Whenever they put on a production, the playwright who wrote that production would be the artistic director. And so it gave playwright full creative control over their own work. And since 13P quote-unquote imploded after they finished producing, there have been other theater companies around the country who have launched in accordance with this model. The Welders, who are at the table right now, Orbital 3 in Philly, who are the newest ones. There is a Boston one and a Minneapolis one, who I believe just closed. So, Workhouse Collective, yes. So, but the interesting thing about these groups is they arrive with big fanfare and they close with a similar energy of excitement of we fulfilled our mission, we did what we set out to do, and so we're done. We don't need to do this for 50 years. And so there's something very valuable in kind of creating a theater company the way you create a show, which is it's just this beautiful moment and then it dissipates after a couple years. And so today we wanted to get some of the first-generation Welders, Jojo Ruff and Gwydion Sullivan, along with the executive producer of Welders 2.0. I think that's the official terminology you guys have been using.
Well, slight shift to a creative producer, but yes.
Yes.
Similar to the first role.
And Rone Pinoy, did I? Ronnie. Ronnie. Yes. Sorry, people mispronounce my name all the time, so I felt really bad about that. Sorry.
It's okay. I respond to Hey You.
Okay, so first question, can either Jojo or Gwydion, can you tell me about why do playwrights want power?
I'm going to turn that to Gwydion since he's a playwright and I am not.
Well, all too often in the American theater, we're jobbed in for a six-week stint at a theater and we don't really have input, let alone control over things that we think are vital to the process surrounding our plays. But more importantly, I think it's critical for playwrights to lead. It's in our tradition. It's in our DNA. You know, there was a guy, you might have heard of him. His name rhymes with Makespeare, and he ran a theater. So this is a tradition we've inherited and that I think is really vital to keep alive. You know, we think a lot about how our work is important for the community in which we're living and making work. So if we aren't leading or being at least part of the leadership picture, it just doesn't make sense.
Right. And the Welders were founded in 2013 with a group of 7 playwrights and Jojo, who's the executive producer.
Five
playwrights. Wait a minute. Okay, the new generation, 7. Yeah.
Indeed.
Okay. See, this is just like the podcast, guys, where I kind of get my facts right some of the time. And so, Jojo, can you... So every 6 months, there's a new artistic director. And so I'm guessing, Jojo, your job is to make sure there's some cohesiveness in terms of management, in terms of finance. So can you tell me a little bit about your role with...
Yeah, definitely. So, so I'm the executive and creative director of The Welders. And the idea, as you say, is that, so we have five, playwrights, and over 3 years we produced five world premieres. And built into our mission is the idea that we're passing it on. So once we did a world premiere by each of our five playwrights, we would pass it on to Welders 2.0 to the next generation. And then they would take it for 4 years and then pass it on to generation 3.0. And so with this new shift in artistic director, as you say, every 6 months, it's, you know, it's a little bit of a shift. Each of our five artistic directors had a different sensibility. And so my job as executive and creative director was, you know, sort of everything you think of as executive director. So keeping finances, helping with development, sort of helping support. But really, at the end of the day, the person that's driving the production forward is our artistic director. I think my job is to continue driving the organization forward.
Right. And so, because I feel like you're the only playwrights collective of the four or five I've named, I've lost count, that have this model of one person is the executive producer. So can you tell me a little bit about why?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at Gwydion a little bit, which no one on the podcast can see, because he, so the group of playwrights came together before I was invited in as an executive and creative director. And, you know, one of the things that I see as my job is figuring out a way to say yes, so that playwrights and the artistic directors don't have to worry about the money. So giving them as much support as possible. But Gwydion, when you came up with the idea...
I'm going to say the best thing I did for The Welders was bring in JoJo. I could sing her praises and often do, and, you know, email me if you want to know how great she is. But the fact of the matter is that we were five people with five big visions and wanting to accomplish five really innovative things that were all different from one another. Without a person to provide structure and continuity and a kind of leadership for the organization, we would have had to focus, sort of divide our attention between leading the organization and leading these immense creative projects at the same time. So really, JoJo said it well. When I am currently the artistic director of The Welders, I was able to lead the organization through this massive project of developing and producing my play, while JoJo was leading the organization through its just natural growth and evolution as a nonprofit.
And so, JoJo, you're leaving with the first generation. So why pass on that particular mantle? Because...
Yeah, I think we felt... So the group of the six of us came together pretty organically. As I said, I was the last one to be brought in. But we created this cohesive unit. And over the past 3 years have become incredibly close. And we felt that the next generation of welders should have the same experience as we did. So the playwrights came together. They applied as a group, including a new executive and creative director, which, as Ronnie said, the title is changing slightly. But we just felt like, you know... I was so strongly connected to the first generation that we wanted the second generation to have their own person. And the organization should continue to evolve and change over time. That's why we built in the pass it on into the mission. And the creative producer, the incoming creative producer, should be part of that.
Yeah. So, Ronnie, why did you decide to manage a theater company?
Well, for me in particular, I was really compelled by the group of playwrights that approached me. Before working with The Welders, I'd been working with a number of larger theaters. And to be approached by this group of artists who essentially said, we really believe in each other. We really love this idea of wanting to, by coming together, elevate each other's voices and give each other stronger productions. I just thought that was incredibly beautiful. And I know a number of the artists in the group. And I was especially moved by the fact that a lot of them are not coming to playwriting from... a typical perspective. So we have a set and costume designer in the group. We have a dramaturg in the group that are going to have a generatively led theatrical process. And I just thought that was so exciting and a great challenge for me as creative producer to say, okay, some of these projects are going to take 6 months to a year to develop. Some are going to be in development for almost the entire length of the time that we'll be having stewardship of the Welders.
Right. Well, you said something really interesting that stuck out to me when I was looking at the 2.0 listing of people, which is there are designers, and so you're going to be producing work from a design-focused perspective.
Exactly.
And so, which isn't very common. And so, what I'm guessing this is a question for Gwydion and JoJo, but when the group, the first generation, were selecting the second generation cohort, like, what were you looking for?
We really wanted people who didn't just want to repeat what we did. We built an organization that in its DNA was intended to evolve from generation to generation. We all work in the nonprofit theater. I'm the director of marketing for Woolly Mammoth. And we love the nonprofit theater, but we're a yes and. We wanted to build a nonprofit that would be less of a bureaucracy and that could evolve to fit the changing circumstances of the arts ecosystem as it evolved in D.C. So that's exactly what's happening. People ask us, they're so different than you. I think it's fantastic. I think it's exactly right that Welders 2.0 is different from us in the ways they're different from us. And I hope Welders 3.0 is different from them as well, you know.
Yeah, I think they're tracking a change that's happening in D.C. that Peter was talking a little bit about, but there are these really exciting newer theater companies that are coming in. 2.0 is incredibly diverse in every sense of the word, the type of work they're interested, their background, what they're bringing to it. And I just, you know, I'm really looking forward to Welders 10.0, which will also reflect the changing organization and the change in D.C. itself.
They'll probably make theater that we've never heard of.
Exactly.
Or they'll be doing all iambic pentameter. Who knows?
Well, what I think is great is that, you know, the creation of the Welders for our generation is such a tremendous gift because getting to inherit something like that, we can just take more risks. We can dive in from the get-go because we have such a fantastic foundation that's been left for us. I mean, being able to inherit a board, a bank account, a structure, that then we have an invitation to kind of make that our own. And the fact that that's been made clear to us that, you know, here, take the mission and vision, embrace it, but then also, you know, live within that, you know, and think about how that wants to involve going forward. And it's made it really exciting for us to think about, okay, what is the layer we want to add on to this to leave a legacy for 3.0?
All right. And so can you tell me a little bit about what kind of a sample of the work, or what's the first thing that's coming up?
Yeah, so our first play is a new play by Stephen Spotswood. Yeah.
he has a really great Twitter account.
Yeah.
He's pretty fantastic.
He's really great. So he wrote a fantastic new play and really was inspired by the Welders model to write it because he knew that he could take a few more risks being a part of this model. And it's called Girl in the Red Corner. And it's about a female mixed martial arts fighter. So we have a great challenge in creating a play that has pretty much 80% of it involves some level of like physical combat and training. Mm-hmm. So I think that for a first, first show out of the gate, I think that's going to be something really exciting.
The whole thing is set inside a mixed martial arts ring, which is amazing.
Yeah. What site specifically?
But
within the theater,
okay. Yeah. But I mean, so what's kind of exciting about this is that our first play, I think, is going to be maybe the only one that may take place inside a traditional theater. I mean, of course, you know, the team, it's a very fluid and evolving process, so we don't know exactly what the second or third piece is exactly going to look like and where it's going to be. But I can imagine that going forward from some of the conversations we've been having, you could be looking at a walking tour or kind of a museum installation theater piece. So I think we got a lot to look forward to.
Right. Well, when it comes to producing a show on this kind of model, I mean, and a playwright as an artistic director, what is the relationship like between them and the executive branch of the theater? Does he just say, I need this much money, give it to me, or...
It's a good question. So we decided before we started that each playwright would get the same amount of money, so they'd get $25,000. And what I do, my role is to sit down with the artistic director ahead of time and figure out what their priorities are. For our very first show, which was Carolina Layaway Grail by Allison Curran, she really wanted to focus. She had a priority of hiring equity actors. We sort of had this amazing director, dramaturg, who worked with her. And so we knew that we needed to fit the budget appropriately, which was very different than Gwydion's piece, Transmission, which was our final piece that just went up at the Alice Performing Arts Center in April and May. And he was the performer in it and wrote it himself. It was him as well as a brilliant performer who did the second act with him and really wanted to focus on sort of these phenomenal designers. So that's where we focus the money. But it's up to them. So it's my job to help make it happen. And all six of us raise the money together. But it's, you know, they're at the helm. So it's just my job to support them as best I can.
Nothing makes you more thoughtful about what you're going to write than having than figuring you have to raise the money and you have to decide exactly how to pay for it.
Yeah. Well, and it definitely lets you know like how much you can get for $25,000, which isn't a lot. So, and is the budget going to be the same for the second iteration?
Yes. Although one of the things that we're looking at is, given that some of these pieces are going to have longer development, we're trying to think creatively, building on the 1.0 model of how going forward we might be able to have some funding for development early on so that pieces 2 or 3 years from now can start now with a little bit of financial support. So that's something we're going to be building in the next couple of years.
And when did the transition process happen? Are you officially... Ronnie, are you officially the executive director now?
Not yet.
She's not, no. As of August 1st. So the metaphor that's my favorite metaphor we're in a marathon and we're about to hand off the baton. So both Ronnie and I are holding onto the baton and have so for about 6 months. 2.0 has been on board for over a year and been helping and sort of watching and onboarding for a full year. And then we will have our explosion party sort of in opposition of what 13P did with their implosion party at the end of their time on July 31st. And then they will take the reins August 1st.
Right. I think it's incredible. It's really incredible what this model asks of you, particularly in the leadership structure, because I know JoJo has been incredibly generous to me in terms of the time that she's spending with me, bringing me on board over the last year. So, I mean, that kind of foresight, knowing for a company to be able to hit the ground running on a certain date, you have to start early and you have to, you know, bring them up to speed at a certain level. So there's just been a tremendous amount of generosity and a lot of sharing of knowledge and sharing of dreams and a lot of combined 14-person meetings in the last couple of months. So it's really been an adventure to kind of figure out a great way to hand this off.
Right. And I feel like it's almost a little, unlike the other ones that we mentioned, most of them will end with a finite end. And so you kind of have this mix between like a long-term organization, but with different people after 3 years.
Exactly.
We're not going away either. I mean, we're going to stay involved to the whatever extent they want us to. I mean, it would be irresponsible of us to have built this thing and then sort of give them the keys and say, good luck, you know. So, you know, in various different ways, we're there for them in to-be-determined capacity.
Yeah, and one of the great things is that because we've been moving forward in such a purposeful way over the past year, we're already having those conversations now about, okay, so what is after August 1st look like? And I know that, you know, my generation is thinking about, oh, when we get invited to, as the welders, participate in things and show samples of our work, of course we're going to want to include the founding welders and their work in those kinds of moments.
So what's the welders really... What's the relationship between the welders and the larger theater ecosystem within D.C.? Do you guys do a lot of co-productions or co-presentations?
We don't co-produce, but we have had various ways of working with other theaters. So we're about to... Can I talk about Forum? Yeah.
Sure.
I just did. Yeah, so
yes.
Forum Theater has invited the welders to create a sort of farewell piece as part of their REACTS project. We've also worked with
the Atlas Performing,
the Atlas
Arts,
Performing
Center.
Arts Center, with the Shakespeare Theaters. Happenings at the Harmon has presented an excerpt of my work. And I think I'm forgetting one or two.
Page the Stage.
The Intersections Festival. So we've been partnering where we can.
I would also say, I think one of the things that made the welders successful is that the six of us are really embedded deeply in this community. So many of us, I mean, I wasn't born here, but I've grown up just outside of D.C. Many of us have been here for 20 or 30 years. We're, you know, they're teachers at AU, at GW. Gwydion works for Woolly Mammoth. I helped produce the Women's Voices Theater Festival. You know, we're really deeply embedded in the community. And so creating an organization that was reflective of that community and also sort of, built for the community in some ways, that we hope that it's an opportunity for future playwrights down the road. But this is not an either or. It's a yes and with the community that already exists.
Yeah, and one of the things I've really admired about the welders so far is the way that at multiple levels you see different individuals at different places in their careers intersecting with the welders. So with Transmission, you had some designers who are really at the top of the field. And then you have in other productions some really emerging artists who are really exciting new talents. So you have a diversity not just of, you know, background or race, but of experience. And I think that kind of intersections does great things for everyone involved.
I'd also say, to answer your question about our relationship to D.C., we love D.C. We love living there. We've had really successful careers. I've been produced by several different theaters in the area and worked with them in a variety of different ways. I was a resident playwright at a small company, etc. This was our way of giving back, of building something additional for the city. I didn't build this to get my play produced. It would be a foolhardy way to get a play produced, really. I spent a lot of time on this effort. It was about building something that would last beyond us, that would be something we could add to the arts ecosystem in D.C.
Well, I mean, the sentiment I've heard from other artists who have created Playwrights Collective is it was a way to get their play produced, or a way to get their play produced the way they want to get it produced.
This feels much more like it has a spirit of service. I've seen it with the Founding Welders, and I'm already feeling it with my group. I mean, particularly given that there are 7 playwrights and myself, you're essentially making a 4-year commitment for one of your plays to be produced within 6 months. So you are giving of yourself, you know, 3.5 years of generosity, whether it's through your work in development or marketing, fundraising or community engagement. I mean, you're really advocating for each other and lifting each other up. And that's really one of the main reasons that I got involved.
Yeah, Allie Curran, one of our playwrights, said really early on that the best thing about the Welders is that 4/5 of the time you're focused on other people. I think that's like the spirit of what we created.
And when we tried to pick the next group, we looked for that spirit in the people. We saw that they were interested in being part of something in which they could give of themselves, not people looking for a shot, looking for a chance to be produced.
I mean, what's necessary for something like this to sprout in other communities? Is it just a group of playwrights coming together and wanting to produce each other?
We've been consulted a lot by this. The list you gave is only a drop in the bucket. There's, yeah, I can think of offhand 6 or 7 others around the country, and a lot of them reach out to us and ask us for advice or just to let us know they're coming right behind us. And that's been really fun and really exciting. I think the biggest thing is a stamina. You know, you need a lot of stamina, a lot of horsepower, a lot of will to build something like this, and a clear vision for why you're doing it. You know, anyone can start a theater company. It happens all the time. And all too often, it's because, well, I wanted to produce this play of mine or of someone else's. I just wanted to do this. Unless you've got a real vision of something big that you can rally people around. If you can't plant a flag, you're never going to get supporters. So we had a flag, and that's what I tell these other companies. Why are you doing it? If you can't answer that in 3 sentences, then don't, you know.
There has to be a need for it. It's like most theater companies.
Yeah, it is, very much, yeah.
Okay, my final question, it may be kind of ridiculous, but why Welders? Are there blowtorches involved?
We do pass a torch.
We do.
A literal torch.
From
at the
AD
end of every,
to
yeah.
AD. So the Welders comes from a poem by Cherry Moraga, who's a poet and a playwright. The title of the poem is The Welder, and the whole poem is about only by taking the hands out of the pockets of the people next to you can you forge your own fire. So it's about doing it yourself and getting your hands dirty and creating something out of nothing. And I think the title has served us well. We all have welders' masks. We pass the torch, as Gwydion
welders
said.
Welders' hoodies now. Welders, you know.
We have welders' hoodies. But it's, you know, we've embraced the terminology.
There's something about, you know, when you're a welder, you're not very pretentious. You're just getting stuff done. You're building stuff. You're making stuff. You're building, you know, you use welding to make a scaffolding. And that's what we did, was build a scaffolding for people to climb on after us. So.
Yeah, and I think, too, for non-traditional playwrights, it feels like a kind of an apt metaphor. So there was a bit of foreshadowing there, I think, too.
Well, that was fantastic, guys.
Thank you
so much.
Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So in the spirit of the Welders, we're moving to a new segment of the podcast. That was wonderful. So I wanted to invite next back Peter Marks from the Washington Post and Karen Zacharias, who was the resident playwright at Arena Stage. Were you the first resident playwright at Arena Stage?
Yes,
Karen?
For the first time. I've been a Z all my life.
So you were first time you're first. So you're no longer the resident playwright at Arena Stage, but you are a resident playwright of DC.
That's fair to say.
Yes.
So I'm going to turn it over to you, Peter, to talk a little bit. You're both residents of DC. You're both theater people. You should have a lot to talk about, right?
He's reviewed Karen.
You've reviewed him.
I've reviewed Karen.
All right.
And yes, Ms. Zacharias was actually in the first class of resident playwrights at Arena Stage, and I remember talking to you when you got picked, because the most amazing thing about that designation was that you got, in my opinion, was that you got health care. And I remember saying to you, you know, what's it like after all these years for a theater to actually give you, you know, access to dentists and doctors as part of the work of being a playwright? Was that an extraordinary thing for you too?
Well, it was kind of a validation that being a playwright is a career, that it is a job, and that it is that we are contributing something, and that my health was important to the organization. That, you know, I should get an asthma inhaler. It was a beautiful gesture in so many ways. It wasn't just investing in me as a writer, but as a person. And I think when institutions invest in you as a whole person, is when you get successful relationships to happen.
Mm. Well, let's. Can we just give people a little of your background, Karen? Just to for those who maybe want to know a little bit more about you. You know, the NEA cites you as one of the most produced Latina playwrights in the country, and I always think, you know, maybe one of the most produced playwrights in the country is also what's going on here. Some people may know your work from any of these titles: Mariela in the Desert, the book club play Legacy of Light, The Sins of Sor Juana, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, you did the adaptation of. How many different theaters have produced your work in this country? Do you know?
Oh, gosh, I don't know, because I guess that's fair to say. I mean, this year I counted, and 14 of my plays had life this year.
Wow.
And this year.
That's
from an elementary school putting on a play to Arena Stage doing Destiny of Desire. And that is the biggest relief and joy about being a playwright, is having your plays, having your babies have a life, no matter where that life is, and that's a relief.
Do you make a living, a full-time living as a playwright? I mean, you earn a yearly amount of money that makes it worth continuing to write plays?
Usually. Sometimes, maybe. I mean, it's like being a real estate agent. It kind of depends year to year how that goes. So, The last year, I could pay for my kids to go take acting lessons.
That's do you write in Spanish too?
Sí, señor. Pero first, I'm interested in writing things first in English. I mean, what I first started to do when I moved to this country is I wanted to create a bridge between where I came from and where I was going to be. And so I thought it was really my first play that I wrote when I was 21 was The Sins of Sor Juana, which is about a very famous poet and political activist from Mexico who is on money. And I came to the United States and nobody knew who she was. Mm. And so my motivation there was just to introduce her in a way that would make people want to do more research about her and get to know her. So that was my first impetus. I didn't know I was going to end up being an American. I didn't. And so when people ask me if I had a donkey at home, when people ask me, tortilla, all these questions, and I was like, well, you do know that we have electricity, and you do know that my dad's went to the university, that we have poets and philosophers and donkeys, but you know what I mean? That we're a very complex culture, that we're part of the Americas. It's been part of a mission of all of my work.
So tell us, I do want to ask you about the political climate, because I think it's really an interesting time to be
Mexican
by,
yeah,
you know, by birth and writing about some of the what's going on in this world. But so you grew up in Mexico City?
Yes, sir.
And so what was the impetus to come here? Was it for college? Did you come to this country?
Oh, no. My father was an epidemiologist. He was working on sexually transmitted diseases. It's an interesting story. And,
he came on a scholarship. He got a scholarship to go to Harvard to get a master's. Wow. And so we moved to Boston, supposedly for 1 year. We were all students. My parents bought, I remember, one queen-size bed, and they moved the box spring and the mattress, and we all slept. My sister and I slept on one bed, and they slept on the other. And a disease popped up that was killing Haitian men and gay men in San Francisco. And nobody knew what that was. And my father was at the forefront of those scientists. And so we moved to Atlanta to be part of the CDC. AIDS? Yeah, so it was the AIDS. We were the AIDS family on the block. and that took that disease changed the whole trajectory of our family's work, and where we ended up living is that, because my father worked for, has the rest of his career was working for AIDS patients on a public health level.
So you come to this country and you become, you know, part of the culture, an important part of the culture, and then you're confronted as an adult with children that you've raised in this country with a political campaign in which suddenly this country next door is demonized, and it sort of in a certain sector of this country legitimized the treatment of people from that country as something you and I are not accustomed to. How does that affect you as a person and also as an artist? What's your having achieved a certain amount of success in this country?
You have to
what do you do with that power?
Yeah.
To have an impact yourself on this conversation. Well,
you need to model it in every single thing that you do, everything that you say, and everything that you write. You have to model what being a woman and a Mexican and an American is all at the same time. It's a complex type of work. And so part of it was, for example, the Latino Theater Commons, which is something when I got the residency at Arena, I wanted to somehow give back. I felt like something big had been given to me. And out of that came the inviting 8 different people from all over the country who were part of Latino artists and saying, well, how do we want to change this conversation? How do we want to do that? And that became the birth of Latino Theater Commons, which started before this whole crazy Trump thing. We were already having this conversation, and it was about how do we update the American narrative to kind of include our stories not as some exotic foreign Carmen Miranda kind of thing, but as a part of the long history and fabric of this life, as a part of that we are part of being Americans, that we're not the other all the time. And then suddenly this guy who was on a reality show started running for president, and his first big thing was attacking the Mexicans with his he was talking about the beauty pageant. That was the first big thing. So my way to kind of combat that was I wrote a play called Destiny of Desire, which is an homage to the telenovelas, because something else that happens is, as a Latina writer, a lot of times if a Latina is on stage emoting emotion, or the play has emotion, people and critics sometimes will use the word telenovela to describe...
Disparagingly.
Right. And so I've gone to see a lot of really interesting dramas by Latino playwrights, and they have nothing to do with a telenovela. I mean, so I decided, I'm going to write the best telenovela ever so that no one ever confuses a dramatic piece of work by a Latino with a telenovela, because a telenovela has certain kind of things that are necessary to make it there. And within that play, which is a Brechtian telenovela, we took down Trump. Even before all of this, it was a way of celebrating and also being subversive at the same time. Because the whole point is to make bridges, to invite people in and say, let's have a party, but let's also have an important conversation underneath that.
Is that a burden? I mean, do you feel do you have the baggage that you have to bring, and the ideas that you have to sort of strike down? Are they different than, say, an Anglo writer who doesn't have these? Or does everybody come with their own issues that they work out and are using as a way of helping people understand their own background and culture?
Of course, every artist has their own issues, and being an artist, no matter what race or gender you are, is always difficult. It's always an uphill battle. But when you are part of a minority, if you're part for you're part of a group that, you know, a regional theater hasn't done a play that represents you in 15 years, that's a much more uphill battle. And it's like I had a friend who had three sons and one daughter, and he once criticized her, goes like, why do you leave the light in the back of the car on when you open the door? That takes away the battery. And she's like, Dad, I'm always worried there might be a guy hiding back there. And he was like, oh, I have never thought about that. And, you know, and it was just his own daughter, the idea that women have to think about different things as they walk down the street and what they think about, is just a perspective that I bring to all my work. And so it's true for every artist. So that's why I find diversity is really important and interesting and vital in keeping the American theater alive, because we will bring a different perspective. We can tell the same story that you've heard from a very different point of view and reinvent it and make you understand something that you have maybe never understood before.
And often theater is the bellwether. It's the art form among the performing arts that really includes before anybody else does. Everyone else sort of follows through, and you know, later on you see 10 years later on television and movies themes that already have become part of the conversation in theaters. People may not know, Karen, that you started a theater in Washington, the Young Playwrights Theater.
Yay.
And was that out of necessity? Was that out of the same kind of motivation that the Welders came into being, because they were looking for a venue for themselves? Was that why you created it?
Well, I did. You know, the YPT was going into schools to teach playwriting as a form of conflict resolution and arts empowerment. And then
you
producing
formed it in the
90s? Plays.
You formed it in the 90s?
I formed it in the 90s when things were looking pretty bleak in the school systems here in D.C. And I think I'd read about third or fourth or fifth kid being murdered after school. And the drug situation was really bad. And I said, well, what do I have that can help? And I said, well, I know how to write a play. And I knocked on the door of a school, the Fillmore Arts Center, and I said to the principal, I've never taught a class, but give me some students and I'll teach playwriting for them for free. And that's how YPT kind of started. And what was great with that is that, you know, then I invited my actor friends who weren't getting work to, you know, do the plays, and we started raising money. And what was interesting, because all my playwrights were Latino and African American playwrights, I needed actors who reflected that reality. And from that, all of a sudden, we became an organization that started with $25,000, and now we're almost, you know, we're at $800,000 organization that's reached, you know, thousands and thousands of kids. We won the White House Award for Best Arts Education Program a couple of years ago.
Mazel tov, as we say in Spanish.
Yes.
and in terms of creating opportunities for actors who've gone on to other, you were telling
well,
me about
you know,
people, Don Ursula.
Don Ursula got one of her first jobs with us. Jefferson Russell got one of their first jobs with us. Pascal Armand, who's sitting there in the Tonys, nominated for that. I directed her in a play written by a 7-year-old boy.
She was in Eclipsed.
Yes, she was in Eclipsed, nominated for a Tony. I directed her in a play written by a 7-year-old boy at Everyday, back in the days of Everyday Theater.
That's great.
So, I mean, this is where theater gets a start, is like people doing the work. And this was, what's the most disenfranchised voice you can think of is the voice of a 12-year-old child. Anywhere in the world, but especially here in D.C.
It's interesting. There are two, for people who don't know much about D.C. theater, there are actually two Spanish-language theaters in Washington, Gala Hispanic Theater and Teatro de la Luna. Both sort of specialize in importing plays from the from Latin America and bringing them here, less sort of organically derived work for the Latino community here, I would say. Is that a fair assumption?
Yes and no. I mean, D.C. is a very unique community in that we have a very strong diplomatic corps. Mm. I mean, we do have every single country representative here and all of the people doing that. So it's serving a need in that sense. But yes, you're right, in the sense of both Gala and Teatro de la Luna, they also, they get, they work a lot within their community. They also do plays that a lot of the diplomatic community likes. But right now, Gala Hispanic Theater is doing El Paso Blue by my good friend Octavio Solis and directed by José Carrasquillo, which is a Chicano play that's being done in English at Gala Hispanic Theater. So, I mean, this whole idea of the diversity of Latino voices is true here in D.C., both in Spanish and in English.
And in fact, Yerma, which was done at Gala, was a big winner this year in the awards, got a lot of awards, a production of Yerma. But I'm also curious, you know, there are large groups of Ecuadorians and other Latinos in this area. I just wonder if you think, you know, given the fact that there are companies emerging like the Mosaic Theater Company doing more work with the African-American community and actors there, for example, do you feel like the Latino community is still sort of marginalized in the theater here?
Absolutely. I mean, there's just no other answer for that. It's still, I mean, there's a language barrier. There's a, you know, there's a distress barrier. There's a worry about papers. And, I mean, there's a lot of different things that come into view for this, but that doesn't mean it's a community that should be ignored, because everywhere you go, you see the Latino community. They're in every single building that you walk into Washington, D.C., there's somebody there.
That's what I'm thinking.
Somebody there, and so it's a huge, instead of seeing it as a problem, it's a huge untapped resource that we could use to feed the theater, the new audiences, and we also have to start having stories that reflect that experience so that people come in and want to see something like El Paso Blue, but also, you know, this is an audience that potentially will love Shakespeare too. I mean, this is where this country is heading to, and it needs to be embrace them instead of building a wall.
Well, that's it. It's a huge opportunity. I think the empathy that's generated after this kind of idiotic attack really does open up a whole avenue for exploration by theater, which is always the first ones in. And should be in this case. We should be seeing plays right now. They should be percolating up that address this kind of lunacy. Sorry, I'm banging the table and it's driving it's driving Deep out of her mind, which I'm not sure is a bad thing. Maybe I should do that. I do think that's something, and I hate to heap that on you, a responsibility. It shouldn't be yours, but I wonder how much you get encouragement from artistic directors in this country to address these things, or are you the sole custodian of your own progress through these kind of social and political issues? Do you get people saying, you know, that was Destiny of Desire, address that in an interesting way? How can you give us something even more direct about that kind of thing, Karen?
I am not getting that directly from artistic directors. I had a great project with the Denver Center, which was called Just Like Us, which was a play about immigration that was set in Denver that Kent Thompson directed. That was a wonderful experience there. But that was a certain kind of commission for that type of thing. I think something that's important, though, is that we're as a Latino artist and, you know, our perspective of looking through different things, it's also important to know that not every play we write has to be an issue play.
Right.
That's something that we're combating, that everybody wants, like, oh, let's do this issue play. And I'm like, well, actually, that issue play is a small part of this whole world that is, you know, the world. I don't walk into my house every moment thinking I'm a Latina who's, could be, you know, deported any moment. I make breakfast. I mean, the buffet.
That's a good point.
The buffet has to be wide, and there's many, many different ways of attacking the problem. And one of is normalizing.
Yeah. Right.
Normalizing the fact that our stories are part, is not some fantastic event that happens once in a while. It's an ongoing story that happens every single day. Mm. And my story is part of your story, Peter, right?
Absolutely. And then the more you're talking, the more I'm thinking about this whole issue of when you think of playwrights like Yung Jin Lee and Brandon Jacobs Jenkins, who are basically saying that in different ways.
Yes.
I would say that the body of your work is actually that statement, because your plays, it's very hard to peg you as one kind of, you're certainly not a single issue writer. To your advantage and your disadvantage, I think it's probably easier to market yourself perhaps, except for the fact that you've got 14 productions of going on at the same time. I don't know how you're doing that of different works. But that said, you are reminding me that we do walk into a theater when you say it's a Latina playwright. We come in thinking, oh, that's what we're going to hear about. We're going to hear Spanish spoken, and that means something about the people we're going to. Right. And that's really unfair.
It is unfair because I don't eat tamales every day.
Those people saying to you, oh, they're donkey. Did you grow up with donkeys? I mean, there's these same ridiculous expectations heaped on.
And I love a tamale. I will celebrate the tamale, too, but it's...
That's a great name for a play. I celebrate the tamale. Yeah,
But it's just the complexity of being a human being in this country at this time has to be shouldered by all of us. And I mean, I think it's just an important thing to keep in focus about. And my plays for children. I mean, I'll tell you one thing: all my plays have in common. They have hope, and they try to elicit some kind of joy or feeling out of the audience. I am not interested in a dead audience experience. I've seen it too many times. I'm not interested for people to just sit back and just think about it. I want people to hoot and holler and have a kind of visceral joy or sadness or something like that. I mean, I think that's part of what Lin-Manuel Miranda, what happens that when Latino writers are coming into the room, I do not come from a place of irony at all. I come from a place of feeling things really strongly and loving them and wanting to share them. And that's my point of view. And sometimes that's disparaged as melodrama or some other things. But for me, it isn't. It's my life.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you're talking about Miranda again, another person who's claimed in the biggest way we're all aware of right now, claiming that story, this most American story as his own, which basically is saying any story can be a story written by Lin-Manuel Miranda. It doesn't really, it's not anyways segregated.
Well, I always think, what if someone else had this idea to take Hamilton and make it into a musical?
Mm-hmm.
It would look so different, right? Mm-hmm. And I can't think of a better, argument for diversity and risk-taking and trying to bring different people in the audience than having a completely different voice tell a story that you've heard before. I just think, it'll become a revelation in many, many ways.
Yeah, I as you were talking, I was even thinking about the fact that Hamilton got into a little bit of trouble when it advertised for in auditions for actors and said, we're looking for actors of color for certain roles. And this is, from the point of view of someone who's interested in seeing this musical again, I do understand why you'd want to find more actors of color. Some of these roles really do cry out for those kind of voices from, not just, white faces doing it again.
Author's intent. This is what the author wanted, and this is what you have to respect. I mean, this is what it comes down to. I mean, cinema is about the director, but theater is about the writer. The idea starts there, and what the author's intent, what is it the author wanted with this play, is what needs to be honored, and that's what he wants. And I think he's telling a story in a very specific way, and it's the job of the producers to make that story as real and as accessible to him, to everybody. So just it's the intent of the writer.
Just last question. What are you working? Are you right now working on a play? Is there something in your that is cooking that you are willing to tell us what it is?
Well, I I'm in a series of second productions and third productions for next year. So there's always that rewrite from what you learned from the first productions. I had Native Gardens at Cincinnati Playhouse that is going to the Guthrie, and so we'll be in Victory Gardens and some other places. And Destiny of Desire, which was at Arena, is going to the Goodman and going to South Coast Rep.
Wow.
And then Into the Beautiful North is in a rolling world premiere with a new... New Play Network. So all of those need rewrites. But yes, I do, Peter, have some new plays that I'm thinking about.
I feel like I'm talking to the CEO of Karen Zacharias, Inc.
Yeah, I'm both the janitor and the president.
Got it. Keeps you honest. That's great. Well, thanks, Karen. It's been fun talking to you
about theater.
Thank you, Peter, Karen, Gwydion, JoJo, and Ronnie. for joining us, and thank you all for joining us for our first live podcast. So you can just you'll find us on the in iTunes, the other places you can do find podcasts. Go there and rate us. It helps people find us. And this will be we'll have links on the show page. Deep, do we need to say anything more?
Nope. Thank you all for coming, and this has been OffScript.